Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Kagyu Path, Lineage by Lama Kathy Wesley. KTC Columbus represents the Karma Kagyu lineage. But what is lineage, and why is it important to our Dharma path? Drawing on Kagyu sources, Lama Kathy will explain the path of Buddha Dharma taught at KTC Columbus, including the history of the lineage and how we practice at KTC. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. I feel like that person in the television programs who is the substitute teacher on a given day, and they go write their name on the board and say, "I am your substitute teacher for today." But I don't have a blackboard, so I'm just going to say hi. My name is Kathy. Be nice to me, please. I'm your substitute teacher for today. Marcus Casey is under the weather today, and I think he's got one of those really bad colds that's going around. And so he's at home, and I'm taking his place on today's Dharma Talk. My topic will be a different one from his, because he wants to be able to give that talk at a later date. So he'll be giving his talk later. Meanwhile, I'm going to speak now for a little while on a topic that I have wanted to talk about for a while, and that is the what lineage means and why Buddhists are in lineages. You know, like why? Why is that? Because there are so many kinds of Buddhism that sometimes it gets a little confusing. You know, you don't know your Zen from your Theravada, from your Vajrayana, from your Tibetan, from your Cambodian, and it gets a little confusing. So I thought I would give a little introduction to the structure of Buddhism in the modern world, but that won't take more than a few minutes. And after that, I'm going to talk about what it is we are doing here. You know, what are we doing in this building? What tradition of Buddhism is this? And what do we, how do we train people? Because a lot of people come to me and they say, "I really like your center, but what is it that you do exactly?" And how do I follow a path of Buddhism here? How do I do that? So it's going to be a little bit of all of those things. And then we'll have questions at the end, if that's okay. All right. So as usual, we're going to start with the taking of refuge and the engendering of the Bodhisattva attitude. And I'm going to recite it twice in English so we can absorb the meaning. And then the last time, I'm going to do my best to chant it in Tibetan so we can get some of the blessing of doing it in the language that is close to the tradition we belong to. So we'll bring our goodness together that we've brought together by coming here today. We'll bring that goodness together and dedicate it to doing something good together for the benefit of everyone. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O sanje chudan so ji cho naham la jang chu pardu dan ni kyap su chi
Da ji jin so ji be se nam ki dro la pen shi san je dro par sho.
Okay, now I'll recite one last little prayer of my own.
O palin sawe lama rinpo che Dagi chiwar pede den shala Kadrin jembo gane je sun te Gu sun tugging a hudrup sal du so.
Okay, thanks so much. So, the topic is kind of a big one. The title of today's lecture is the Kagyu Path. And Kagyu means is the name of our tradition of Buddhism, and it's spelled in English K-A-G-Y-U. K-A-G-Y-U. And so I'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, I want to give you a little bit of a survey of how Buddhism is arranged in the modern world. Everybody knows the story of Prince Siddhartha, who became the Buddha 2,500 years ago in a small city-state in northern India. After 6 long years of study and practice with all the great practitioners and masters of his day, he entered into a very deep meditation. And during that deep meditation, he experienced a transcendent state of mind that he later called Buddhahood or enlightenment. So most folks are familiar with his story, so there's not much need for me to repeat that story. But what happened after Prince Siddhartha passed away is very interesting. For 45 years, he taught all over northern India. And after his death, around the age of 80, his monastics, his men and women monastics and followers, stayed together in their monastic communities, supported by the lay people. And they continued to practice and themselves attained Buddhahood and awakening. So this tells us one unique thing about Buddhism. That is, the Buddha himself denied being a god. Everybody asked him, oh, you're a Hindu, so therefore you must be one of the Hindu gods. Which one? And of course, he said, no, I'm not God. And they said, well, are you an ordinary person? And he said, I'm an enlightened person. So that placed him in the middle between ordinary and divine. But what was interesting about his teaching was that anyone could practice. Anyone, no matter what social class they were born into, from the lowest class to the highest class, men, women, all beings, every human could follow his teaching and practice. And he said all of them could attain. And in this way, he was preaching and teaching a very equanimity. He was teaching and practicing equanimity at the very deepest level by saying everyone had the potential for Buddhahood. In fact, he was considered a radical in his society, and there were demonstrations, but we won't get into that. Anyhow, but after his death, the men and women in his practice community continued to practice. And then after their passing, then the subsequent communities practiced and studied together. And every year they would get together for the rainy season retreat, and they would recite the teachings of the Buddha to each other, because the Buddha's main disciple, Ananda, had total recall. He could recall absolutely everything the Buddha said. And so the tradition of memorizing the Buddha's teachings through what became known as the sutras, or the words of the Buddha, That tradition began among the monks and nuns. And that kept going and kept going. And some form of memorization of the Buddhist teachings still occurs today in modern Buddhist communities all over the world. A few hundred years after the death of the Buddha, these scriptures, actually 100 years after the death of the Buddha, the scriptures began to be written down. And they were written down in three collections: the sutras, which were the words of the Buddhas, and then the Vinaya, which is spelled V-I-N-A-Y-A, or some people call it Vinaya. Vinaya or Vinaya, which is the monastic discipline rule book. You know, you got to have a rule book. And then the last set of teachings he gave was called the Abhidharma. That's spelled A-B-H-I-D-H-A-R-M-I. Abhidharma. And that first H may not be in there, so my spelling may be off. And it means, you know, like the primordial Dharma. And it has to do with the Buddhist teaching on the cosmos and the world. And so those were the first three sets of scriptures that were written after the death of the Buddha. And that was 100 years later. And then after that, more scriptures were discovered. And these became known as the Mahayana scriptures. Maha means great, and yana means vehicle or path. So the very earliest Buddhists kept practicing with the Pali, which was the language of the first scriptures. It was in Pali, that's P-A-L-I, for those of you who want to look it up. The Pali scriptures were these first three collections, the sutras, the Vinaya, and the Abhidharma. But later, other sutras appeared, and these were differentiated from the Pali scriptures by calling them the Mahayana scriptures, the great vehicle scriptures. And they were written about by the great Indian master, Nagarjuna. Now that's a mouthful. Naga, N-A-G-A, R, J-U-N-A, Nagarjuna, if you want to look him up. He was quite remarkable. And so essentially at that time, that was when Buddhism split into two different groups. Those who followed only the Pali scriptures, and those who followed both the Pali scriptures and the Mahayana scriptures. And these roughly fell along geographic lines. Most of the Theravadan practitioners of the southern Asian countries, the word Thera, T-H-E-R-A, Vada, V-A-D-A. Theravada means the path of the elders. And so those very oldest Buddhist scriptures are the ones that are practiced by the path of the elders, Theravada. And then those were the southern schools of Buddhism. The northern schools of Buddhism are all of the various Mahayana groups that follow both scriptures, the Pali and the Mahayana scriptures. And so, in this way, Buddhism split into northern and southern schools. And so, our school of Buddhism that we have here is one of the northern Mahayana schools, because our tradition comes from a northern country, in this case, Tibet. And so, that is how Buddhism had its initial life, how its initial split, and now, there are subgroups in both the Theravadan tradition and in the Mahayana tradition. And all the subgroups are along the lines of what's called a transmission lineage. Now, we all know transmissions are in cars, so we're not going to kind of go there. But in Buddhism, a transmission is when a teacher meets a disciple and gives a teaching. That's called a transmission. The teacher meets the disciple and gives a teaching. And these transmissions can be as simple as learning how to meditate, or as complicated as how to do a mantra practice, or as profound as being introduced to the nature of your mind so that you can practice to become a Buddha also. So these lineages of transmission follow from a great master to their disciples and down the line. Essentially coming from centuries ago, an enlightened being through another set of hopefully enlightened beings to us today. And the Tibetan lineages began to happen in the, I'm going to say in the 700 AD or Common Era, about somewhere between 700 and 800 AD. That's when the Buddhism first went to Tibet. And the great master who helped to establish Buddhism in Tibet was known as Guru Rinpoche. And after Guru Rinpoche's time, another set of teachers bearing lineages from India were invited to Tibet. And so they brought their lineages of transmission to Tibet. And eventually, Tibetan Buddhism developed four distinct styles of practice, two that emphasize study and two that emphasize meditation. And we're one of the two meditation communities. So that's a little bit about the history of Buddhism. Sorry, it might have been a little boring, but hopefully it will give you some ideas as to how we ended up here. Because in this community, our community formed around a monk who was sent from India to the United States in 1976. There was a Tibetan monk who had escaped from Tibet. Those of you who know a little bit about Chinese history and Tibetan history know that in the 1950s, the 14th Dalai Lama, who is alive today, it's the Dalai Lama everybody knows today, was just a young man. He was just a teenager. And the communist government in Beijing sent troops to occupy Tibet. And they allowed the Dalai Lama, who at that time was the king of Tibet, they allowed him to remain in place. But in 1959, there was an uprising against the communist government, and there was a brutal crackdown. And during the brutal crackdown, a lot of monasteries were destroyed because it was thought that the monks and nuns were responsible for the uprising. And so many religious people fled Tibet in 1959, fleeing for their lives. And among them was the founder of our center, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. He recalled being shot at as he crossed the border by army troops who were trying to kill and stop as many people from leaving as possible. And he got away with his life, as did many of his friends. And he settled in India in a refugee camp and then got sent here in 1976 to teach us. So think about this, right? The Kagyu lineage, our lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, which started 1,000 years ago in India with the great master Tilopa. He was a great enlightened being, and he had a vision of the Buddha who taught him how to meditate on the nature of mind. And he called that teaching the Great Seal, S-E-A-L, the Great Seal, like the Great Authenticity, or Maha Mudra. So 1,000 years ago, this great Indian master achieved enlightenment, had a vision of how to teach this, and then he handed those teachings called Maha Mudra down to his next generation and their next generation and theirs and theirs and theirs and theirs into Tibet when Marpa the translator came to visit in the 1000s, no, 1100s, and took it home with him. And then we have this master of the Maha Mudra who comes from India to the United States in 1976 and shows up on our doorstep in 1977 because he was invited to be here by a young couple who were very idealistic and said, Columbus, Ohio needs meditation. Can you believe it? They were in their 20s and they had been part of the hippie movement But they knew that Buddhism and meditation would be important for this community, and so they invited a Tibetan monk to come and teach them. And he created the center that became Columbus Karma Teksum Choling. And so that's a little bit about us. Our tradition is 1,000 years old. It's 2,500 years old if you go all the way back to the Buddha. And then this particular transmission lineage, this transmission of the teachings on Mahamudra, this is 1,000 years old. And it's still being done today. There are a couple of people in this room who've actually received transmission of Mahamudra from the masters. And so there are people living today who are still getting that transmission from 1,000 years ago. And that is why lineage is important, because the masters of the lineage keep it alive through their practice. They don't just read a book and learn something intellectually. They are introduced to it through meditation from their masters. And then they achieve some solidity and stability in their practice, and then they pass it on. Maybe the ones who are passing it on themselves may not be enlightened, but they have the transmission and they keep it and they practice it and they have solid experience and they have solid understanding and solid blessing of that transmission, and they give that transmission to the next generation. So that's what this place is all about. Yes, we do teach meditation, and we're very happy about that, because it doesn't matter if the people we teach meditation to decide to go on to practice Kagyu lineage practices or not. That's fine. We figure that over the last 40 plus years, because the center's 45 years old now, you know, if there's like somewhere between 5 and 10 new people who come to Introduction to Meditation every week. And so if we count all of those people, those 5 or so every week for 40 years, it's in the thousands of people who've learned how to meditate through the activity of this one man who escaped Tibet in 1959 and was invited here by an idealistic young couple who felt meditation would be important for this community. And it just blows my mind just to think about it. Just to think about what are the chances, right? So that's a little bit about how we got here and what we represent. We mainly teach the introduction to meditation. That's our main thing, is teaching everybody who comes in the door how to meditate. We teach them that. But then if they want to pursue the Kagyu path, we've got that too. And that is the next phase of training for people. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, when he was telling me about, how do you train people in Buddhism? He said, in America, you don't grow up knowing about the Buddha. Very few people grow up knowing the story of the Buddha or knowing what Buddhism is. He said, so you're going to be catching them at a time when they're not quite prepared. So they may not really have faith in the Buddha or really understand any of all of that. He said, teach them meditation. He says, if you teach them meditation, he said, even beginners who meditate will have a different experience of their mind. They'll actually experience their mind in a different way than they ever have before. And he said, that will give them confidence that maybe the Buddha had something to say, and maybe the Buddha had something to say to them personally. And maybe they'll want to study and practice then. And so Rinpoche's philosophy has borne out to be true. By sitting and meditating, that's how we begin. And he said, after a person has meditated for a while, you can help them with their problems. Because a lot of people develop problems in meditation. Sometimes they get sleepy, sometimes they get agitated, sometimes they experience pain, sometimes they have bad memories arise while they're meditating. All kinds of things can happen while people are meditating. And so basically our work is to answer those questions, help them solve those problems, and help them progress in their meditation, because quiet sitting meditation is just the beginning. Quiet sitting meditation calms our minds down enough so that we can begin to learn about the teachings of Buddhism. You know, the Four Noble Truths, right? Suffering's part of life. Suffering has a cause. Suffering has a solution. And there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. That's basic Buddhism. Suffering's a part of life. We kind of got that down already because we've had some. The suffering, the cause of suffering, we may not be as familiar with because we sometimes think of this cause of suffering as being external to us. You know, it's the boss, or it's the system, or it's this, or it's that. It's outside of us. We think of the problem, the cause of suffering, as being outside of ourselves. But the Buddha's teaching is that grasping and clinging, our habits of grasping and clinging, actually cause a lot of our suffering. And so if grasping and clinging is causing our suffering, that means that if we can somehow reverse the cause of suffering by reversing grasping and clinging, that we will have happiness. And this is the second and third noble truth. The second noble truth is that suffering has a cause, and that cause is clinging and fixation. And then that leads to the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering, which comes about when we learn how to let go of grasping and clinging. But then you can't just say to somebody, oh yeah, just let that go, just let it go. You can't do that because you don't give them a method. And that's why the Buddha taught the fourth noble truth, which was all the methods, all of the methodology to reverse fixation and clinging. And those are summarized in the fourth noble truth, which is the path that leads to the end of suffering. And to briefly state the fourth noble truth, the practices, do no harm whatsoever, practice virtue as much as possible, and tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Doing no harm whatsoever means don't harm yourself, don't harm others. Do as much benefit or virtue as possible means to take care of yourself and benefit others, and tame your mind. That means to meditate so that you can learn how to not do harm and to do virtue. So after a person has been practicing meditation for a while, one of the number one things they tell me is that, hey, I've realized something. I have a lot of bad karma. For some reason, people don't really understand the karmic theory very much until after they've been meditating for a while. And once they begin to see how their thoughts create their experience of the world, they say, wait a minute, I think maybe in the past I've created a lot of bad habits. How do I undo those bad habits now? And that's where Buddhist ethics come in. And so that's usually the second thing we teach in this tradition is ethics. How not to harm oneself, how not to harm others. And then we also teach how to benefit ourselves and how to take care of ourselves and how to benefit others. And that is the teachings called bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening and citta means mind. So we teach people how to practice love and compassion, because that's really the heart and soul of bodhicitta, is love and compassion. So that's the next form of meditation that we teach people, is love and compassion meditation. Shamatha, which is quiet sitting, is first. A little bit about Buddhist ethics is next. After that, we teach love and compassion meditation. And then if people want to keep going, they can learn mantra practice. And we can teach them a little bit about the transformational work that is happening in mantra practice. And then finally, if they want to enter the Kagyu path and become a Mahamudra practitioner, there's a series of teachings and practices that they can do to enter that path. And so all of those things are possible here. That's what we're here for, and that's what we do. And thank you for, listening to my TED Talk. Because I wanted to at least... For the sake of everyone who's watching and who's here today and who's watching on YouTube and Facebook, just to let you know that there is a path, and it's got lots of history to it. There's a lot of people who have attained enlightenment through this 1,000-year-old Kagyu path, and there will be more in the future, and that the place we've built here with all of your help is, we built this, all of us together, to house this tradition as it moves forward. And I did promise I would tell you what Kagyu meant, and then we'll close and get and take questions. K-A, is literally the first letter of the Tibetan alphabet. Ka. And it has, and it's the word for word. Ka is the word for word, and it is, it also means command, like the command of a monarch or of a master. And so the connotation of Ka in this context is the command of the master or the Buddha. So Ka in this context means the word of the Buddha, or specifically the word of transmission of the instructions of the Buddha, specifically the transmission lineage of Mahamudra. So Ka refers to the teachings of the Buddha, but specifically the Mahamudra transmission, which has come 1,000 years to us. And then Ju, G-Y-U, means lineage or continuity. And that's what keeps what we have here alive, is that every generation there is transmission of these sacred instructions down through time, and people, it's like one candle lighting each another candle all the way through time. And it keeps the lineage alive. And it's living because human beings are holding that lineage and practicing that lineage and being part of that lineage. And that's what keeps it alive, because our practice makes us alive and it makes our spiritual life alive. It transforms us from the inside. And so then we have that spiritual life that we then pass on to the next generation. So that was all I prepared for today's talk, was to talk a little bit about the history of Buddhism, how we came to have the northern and southern schools of Buddhism. And it was a real rough review, because it didn't have exact dates for everything. But you can find out all about these traditions by reading online. There's a wonderful website that's called kagyuoffice.org, and that's spelled kagyuoffice.org. And they have a full history of Buddhism on that website. You can go to that website and click on Buddhism and then history, and then you'll get the history of Buddhism in India, the history of Buddhism in Tibet, and a little bit about the lineage. One more thing. I wanted to introduce this new painting that we have here. We have a painting of the very first of the Karmapas. The Karmapas arose in, I'm going to get my centuries wrong. Let's see, they were after Gampopa, so I'm going to say they arose somewhere around the 11th or 12th centuries. Dusun Kempa was the very first Karmapa, and he's depicted in the center of that painting. And he's surrounded by all of the Karmapas that followed. The 16, there are 16 total in this painting, depicted in this painting. Each one was a real human being who had a life story, who had activities, who did things, who taught things, who helped the lineage continue. And so that's how the lineage has been handed down from one generation to the next in our Kagyu lineage, because as you know, there are many sub-Kagyu lineages, all of which go back to the lineage of Tilopa, the Indian master. So anyhow, I wanted to introduce that to you because I forgot that I had it. Somebody gave it to me and I forgot I had it. And I said, well, this is the best place for it since we're Kagyu and specifically we're Karma, K-A-R-M-A, Karma Kagyu. Karma in this case, in this context, means the Karmapa. So we're of that lineage. So, and we also have, we don't have it here today, we have a new portrait of Karmapa we're going to start displaying next week. It is a formal portrait of His Holiness the 17th Karmapa sitting in meditation. And so that will be, that will replace the picture of him as a teenager that you're seeing there. So in any case, sorry, that was a side, that was a little bit of a sidebar. But let's have some discussion. If anybody has questions about the history of Buddhism or has questions about what a lineage is or meditation, you can even ask meditation questions. Because since I'm your substitute teacher, I can really talk about a lot of stuff. Although I won't talk about yesterday's OSU game because I didn't see it. Sorry.
Good morning. Thanks for those blueberry muffins.
Hey, I really am glad you like those. My husband is a baker, and so he and I did those yesterday. Those are outstanding.
My question regarding Buddhism is, you were talking about the geographical split in India, and I'm curious about the lineages that went to Burma, Thailand, Laos, those Southeast Asia kind of things.
I can't say as much about those because I don't know the specific history, but what I can tell you is that they are Theravadan, but I don't know that, I don't know much about the sub lineages of the Theravadan tradition. Yeah, I get fuzzy there. Yeah, but thank you for asking. My teacher told me never be afraid to tell people you don't know something. He said, in fact, that's one of the most powerful things you can tell people sometimes. I don't know. He said, definitely don't make anything up. So, but thank you for asking. I'm sorry I can't answer. Other things people might want to talk about. Yeah, it is, I am open for business. Since it was a general talk, you can ask about anything.
So I had a question about one of the teachers in the lineage that you'd mentioned named Guru Rinpoche.
Yeah.
That's right. So I notice the word Rinpoche, guru just means teacher.
Right.
And then Rinpoche is a title at the end of many people's names.
Right.
So that doesn't really, it's not really the name, is it?
I hear what you're saying. Boy, I really understand this. I get to introduce you to two concepts here. One is how interesting it is to be a Tibetan Buddhist in America, okay? Period, because Tibetans tend to use both Sanskrit and Tibetan terminology interchangeably without even thinking. Because monastics in school, monastery school, they learn all of the names of the great masters in Sanskrit and in Tibetan. And then they confuse people like us who don't know that they are the same person. So Guru Rinpoche is also known as Padmasambhava, or the Lotus Born, okay? Padma means lotus, Sambhava means born, so the Lotus Born. So we've got that. And you're right, Rinpoche, R-I-N-P-O-C-H-E, it's a Tibetan term that means precious, precious one, or one who is precious. And it is, so for the Tibetans, Guru Rinpoche, or Padmasambhava, was, they call him the second Buddha. You know, in Tibet, they call him the second Buddha because he was like the Buddha for them, because he's the one who really made it happen. There were lots of Buddhist teachers who came before him, but he was the one who helped establish Buddhism in Tibet so that it wouldn't die out. Because after he left, after his era was over, an anti-Dharmic king came to power in Tibet and tried to stamp out Buddhism, but it didn't work. And after the anti-dharma king's death, Buddhism returned with a vengeance, so to speak, with a fervor, with the spreading of the new traditions of Buddhism after the 10th and 11th century. But anyway, so Rinpoche is a title that's granted to Tibetan teachers. Something interesting, it's only granted by people above the person. A person's students may call them Rinpoche, but they're not really a precious teacher until they have manifested qualities from their meditation. And then their teacher gives them the title. But Guru Rinpoche, I think he's grandfathered, so he gets the title. Now, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's fun to be able to tell people about some of the fun stuff with Tibetan Buddhism. Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Maybe this might be a bit complicated
question.
Okay, how did the mantras come about?
Oh, the mantras?
Yeah.
I got a general idea. I'll tell you what I've heard about it. There are two sets of scriptures that
but were they written by?
They are mostly attributed. The mantras that we use today are attributed to the Buddha Shakyamuni.
But did he write them?
Here's what they say. They said that during the Buddha's lifetime, he actually spoke all of the scriptures. They say he spoke the Mahayana scriptures. You know, he spoke the Theravadan scriptures. He spoke the Mahayana scriptures. And he spoke something called the tantras. And some of the mantras appear in the Mahayana sutras. And some of the mantras appear in the tantras. But the Buddha is said to have been the author of them all. And you know, he was a busy man. He did teach for 45 years after all. So there's plenty of time.
Okay.
But yes, they are attributed to him. Many of the mantras, though, have an interesting sidelight in that they are also the names, forms of the names of some of the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas. Like, for example, the Buddha Vajradhara, who appeared to Talopa in that vision and gave him the Mahamudra transmission, his mantra is Om, his name Vajradhara, Hum. So there, a lot of the mantras are the names of the various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And they're mainly taught in the Mahayana sutras as well as in the tantras.
I was just wondering, because in the Catholic religion, there is the Bible, and it has different segments that are John, Paul.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
those were written, but it was written after Christ, many, many centuries later. And I wondered about the same thing, if in fact one of the lamas actually wrote a segment, and then there was a continuation with other.
Now I understand your question. Yeah, here's what I know of this. The sutras, and you know, the sutras and the Vinaya and the Abhidharma from the Theravadan scripture, the Pali scripture, those were all spoken by the Buddha. In the Mahayana scriptures, some of them were spoken by the Buddha and some of them were spoken by others who were present in the presence of the Buddha. Tantras, the Buddha took the form of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to give that teaching. So those are all considered to be the sutras, whether they're the Theravadan sutras or the Mahayana sutras, they're all considered to be words of the Buddha. However, there are something called shastras, and that's spelled S-H-A-S-T-R-A, shastra. And shastras mean commentaries, and those were written by lamas and other masters. So those are not considered words of the Buddha. They aren't considered to be sutras. They're considered to be shastras, which explain the meaning of the sutras. And so that's and so the Buddha gave the mantras and so forth in the Mahayana sutras and the tantras. But then lamas came along later to explain the meaning of all of that. So, for example, when we get our new set of scriptures that are going to go in this new shrine that we're going to have, there will only be the 100+ volumes of the sutras. But you can also acquire the shastras. It's called, the Tibetans have two collections. One is called the Khanjur, because there's Ka again, the word of the Buddha, K-A-N-G-Y-U-R, Khanjur. Probably not spelling that right. But those are the words of the Buddha. And then there's the Tengur, like T-E-N-G-Y-U-R, something like that. And those are all the shastras. Those are all the commentaries, and the, you know, so they revere them both.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Because it,
sorry?
It has been a little confusing.
I tell you, I understand that. It took me a long time to figure it out myself. So I had to ask the lamas a lot of questions.
Thank you.
I know. Thanks. We got time for a couple more. If there's a couple more out there. Yes.
Hi, I wondered if there was any like symbolism to colors we see in Buddhism? Because
sure.
I feel like I've noticed some monks wear like one color of robe and then other monks in a different tradition will wear like a different color robe. I just wondered if there was any significance to that.
There is. I may not be able to explain it all, but yes. In the southern traditions, of Buddhism, the Theravadan traditions, they do mainly wear goldish robes, kind of like what you got on there. So they wear goldish color. And it's and the color was chosen, I was told by my teacher, that saffron color was chosen because it would make the followers of the Buddha stand out. Okay, from the lay persons in the society, it would be plain, and that it would be not like highly decorated or jeweled or anything like that. It would be very plain clothing, but it would be only one color, and that way, and this particular color, he chose because it would make them stand out. Now, when Buddhism went to other countries, culture kind of took over. And so you will see in some of the Mahayana Buddhist schools, like the Zen schools, they will wear robes that are gray or black. And I've seen some wear other colors as well, but gray and black are mainly used because that's the aesthetic of their culture, that was what would make them stand out. Now in Tibet, they decided to use a darker color of red, the color of red I'm wearing, because it was easier to make. But it also would make them stand out, but because they had the vegetable, you know, dyes or whatever to make this color, and this was something they could do. They also wanted to make the robes heavier in Tibet, because in southern countries it was very warm, so that the robes were very thin. And so in Tibet, they actually added extra robes. They had a vest and things like that, and then jackets and so on, because they needed more protection from the weather. Mm-hmm. But I honestly cannot remember the symbolism, but I think there's a book that Trungpa Rinpoche wrote about monasticism, and it's probably in there, but I could look it up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Buddha apparently said that his followers could wear this saffron color, you know, the yellow, the red, and also blue, and so forth. And that's why the Tibetan robes, because lay people wore a lot of blue, so they just made like piping on the vests were blue. In this room will be decorated in 5 colors. Each of the 5 colors symbolizes the overcoming of one type of mental affliction and the uncovering of one kind of Buddha wisdom. So there are five Buddhas, what they call the five families of Buddhas, and they are they're all about the transformation of negativity into something awakened. And so each one of the colors has a different meaning. And you'll see them all here. This yellow that we have today is just one color. There's going to be a bunch more. And they will all be in trim that goes around, because we're having a wallpaper made that will be at the tops of the walls and at the chair rail. And it'll go all the way around the room. And they're beautiful, and there'll be lotus flowers painted on them, which is symbolic of the spiritual person who lives in the world but isn't stained by the world, just like, you know, the lotus grows in mud but it blooms above it, and that kind of thing. There might be mantras written on the walls too.
Thank you.
Okay, no, thanks for your question. Yeah. Yes. How am I doing on time? Oh, good.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
You know, thanks for your question.
You say that my thought creates my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So what? I should be non-judgmental, have compassion, know that there's space between everything, accept and forgive, and then deal with the five mental afflictions.
I'm liking that. That's sounding good to me.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. If you like, I'll quote from the Buddha himself. The Buddha's, everybody asks, is there a Buddhist Bible? And I say, kind of. It's like more than 100 volumes, so it's a little hard to put it on a bookshelf. However, if people want to read the most basic teachings of the Buddha, they appear in his collection of sayings, the Buddha's sayings, called the Dhammapada. That's spelled Dhammapada, or Dhammapada. So he starts by saying, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. And so I'll put this on our Facebook page so you don't have to write it, but that's the first words. We are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. And so then he goes on to give his basic teaching on karma. He said, if we think, speak, and act with an impure mind, suffering will follow us just as surely as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart. Then he repeats the teaching, we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. Then he says, if we think, speak, and act with a pure mind, happiness follows us like a shadow that is unshakable. And he says, hate never once dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible. You too shall pass away. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? So that's the only part of it I got memorized. The rest of it I don't have memorized, but those opening words I've got memorized because they're just so profound. And it really gives the entirety of the Buddhist teachings in this just really short and pithy form. So I would say that all of the behavior you describe, you know, being non-judgmental, being forgiving, all of those behaviors are part of that thinking, speaking, and acting with a pure mind. Because the dotted line that differentiates the pure mind from the impure mind is selfishness. When my teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, taught us, he said, you know, selfishness is really the cause, the root cause of all of our suffering, especially when we try to overpower other people and hurt them in order to get what we want. So I think you're on to something with your list of things to remember.
So I sure hope I can find that on the computer.
You sure can, and I will, here's where I will tell everyone, and it'll be on the recording. The particular translation that I'm working from, or that I memorized for you, is the one by Thomas Byrom, and that's B as in boy, Y-R-O-M, B-Y-R-O-M, Thomas Byrom. His translation, you can look it up online, and you can read it online, and you can actually buy it. So it's my favorite, because it's just so straightforward.
Thank you
so much, yeah. And this will be our last question, thank you. Yeah, hi.
I have a meditation question. What would you recommend when meditating? I'm often experiencing a tightness in my chest. I'm not thinking anything particular anxious or, you know, having worried thoughts or anything, but I'm noticing I get this tightness, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a self-perpetuating cycle. I'm noticing it, and I can't move past.
Yeah, this actually happens to people, and you're not the first person who's reported this. And so I've talked to a couple of lamas, the Tibetan teachers, about this because it is a bit bothersome. And there's a couple of things you can do. I think there's a bit of meditation technique that you might call reversal, which is where when you feel the tension, you consciously relax it. I had a friend of mine tell me that if you can just lower your shoulders and then let every part of your body relax, that can be a way of working with it, because the tension comes from a tightness, and so the tightness could be in the way that we are applying our technique, because it could be that we're pressing a little too hard on our attention, right? Instead of allowing the attention to settle and relax, we're tightening a bit and then the body will react. It's because the body and mind are really close friends, you know, and sometimes they're friends and sometimes not so much, you know. But what I was taught was anything that you can do that opens the perspective will help with that. And another thing that a lama taught me is that you can actually like take your attention away from meditation for a little while and just look out the window at the blue sky and let your mind sort of dissolve into the blue sky. Just let it relax like that. I think that's also a thing that you can do. And if those things, don't help, then let's talk some more, because those are a couple of immediate things that come to my mind. Is that I myself have also experienced this, and the physical relaxation did help, and then also being a little less tight with the technique also helped, because this actually happened to me too. And I think the idea of it being expansive is kind of interesting, and we can talk more about that. Okay? Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, no, thanks. Yeah, the cool thing about that is, I mean, it's a little bothersome, right? You know, it's a little bothersome, but what's cool about that is that shows you how the mind and the body work together. It's like, oh, we can help each other, and now we have to figure out how to make that happen, how to help them work together. So thank you. Well, we'll have to stop here for today, but I appreciate your being here and your asking the questions and you know, all of that. This is all good. And then I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and I'll be teaching another Dharma talk. This one might go a little bit more toward meditation and finding out how meditation is. So we'll gather together all the goodness that we've accomplished here today together, and we will dedicate it to all sentient beings, making the aspiration that all beings are free from suffering and come to Buddhahood. We'll just do this one in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thanks, everyone. Yeah, and thank you to the sound department. Yeah, okay, we'll see you again soon. Drive safely.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.